The fourth book of the Dialogues of Lucius Annaeus Seneca, addressed to Novatus. Of Anger, Book 2. 1. My first book, Novatus, had a more abundant subject, for carriages roll easily downhill. Now we must proceed to drier matters. The question before us is whether anger arises from deliberate choice or from impulse, that is, whether it acts of its own accord, or like the greater part of those passions which spring up within us without our knowledge. It is necessary for our debate to stoop to the consideration of these matters, in order that it may afterwards be able to rise to loftier themes. For likewise in our bodies, the parts which are first set in order are the bones, sinews, and joints, which are by no means fair to see, albeit they are the foundation of our frame and essential to its life. Next to them come the parts of which all beauty of face and appearance consists, and after these, colour, which above all else charms the eye, is applied last of all, when the rest of the body is complete. There is no doubt that anger is roused by the appearance of an injury being done. But the question before us is whether anger straightway follows the appearance and springs up without assistance from the mind, or whether it is roused with the sympathy of the mind. Our, the Stoics' opinion is, that anger can venture upon nothing by itself without the approval of mind. For to conceive the idea of a wrong having been done, to long to avenge it, and to join the two propositions, that we ought not to have been injured, and that it is our duty to avenge our injuries, cannot belong to a mere impulse which is excited without our consent. That impulse is a simple act, this is a complex one, and composed of several parts. The man understands something to have happened, he becomes indignant thereat, he condemns the deed, and he avenges it. All these things cannot be done without his mind agreeing to those matters which touched him. 2. Whither, you say, does this inquiry tend? That we may know what anger is. For if it springs up against our will, it will never yield to reason, because all the motions which take place without our volition are beyond our control and unavoidable, such as shivering when cold water is poured over us, or shrinking when we are touched in certain places. Men's hair rises up at bad news, their faces blush at indecent words, and they are seized with dizziness when looking down a precipice. And as it is not in our power to prevent any of these things, no reasoning can prevent their taking place. But anger can be put to flight by wise maxims, for it is a voluntary defect of the mind, and not one of those things which are evolved by the conditions of human life, and which, therefore, may happen even to the wisest of us. Among these, and in the first place, must be ranked that thrill of the mind which seizes us at the thought of wrongdoing. We feel this even when witnessing the mimic scenes of the stage, or when reading about things that happened long ago. We often feel angry with Clodius for banishing Cicero, and with Antoninus for murdering him. Who is not indignant with the wars of Marius, the proscriptions of Sulla? Who is not enraged against Theodotus and Achilles, and the boy who dared to commit a more than boyish crime? Sometimes songs excite us, the quickened rhythm and the martial noise of trumpets. So, too, shocking pictures and the dreadful sight of tortures, however well deserved, affect our minds. Hence it is that we smile when others are smiling, that a crowd of mourners makes us sad, and that we take a glowing interest in another's battles, all of which feelings are not anger, any more than that which clouds our brow at the sight of a staid shipwreck is sadness, or what we feel when we read how Hannibal, after Cannae, beset the walls of Rome, can be called fear. All these are emotions of minds which are loath to be moved, and are not passions, but rudiments which may grow into passions. so too a soldier starts at the sound of a trumpet, although he may be dressed as a civilian and in the midst of a profound peace, and camp horses prick up their ears at the clash of arms. It is said that Alexander, when Xenophantus was singing, laid his hand upon his weapons. 3. None of these things which casually influence the mind deserve to be called passions. The mind, if I may so express it, rather suffers passions to act upon itself than forms them. A passion, therefore, consists not in being affected by the sights which are presented to us, but in giving way to our feelings and following up these chance promptings. For whoever imagines that paleness, bursting into tears, lustful feelings, deep sighs, sudden flashes of the eyes, and so forth, are signs of passions and betray the state of the mind, is mistaken, and does not understand that these are merely impulses of the body. Consequently, the bravest of men often turns pale while he is putting on his armour. When the signal for battle is given, the knees of the boldest soldier shake for a moment. The heart, even of a great general, leaps into his mouth just before the lines clash together, and the hands and feet, even of the most eloquent orator, grow stiff and cold while he is preparing to begin his speech. Anger must not merely move, but break out of bounds, being an impulse. Now, no impulse can take place without the consent of the mind, for it cannot be that we should deal with revenge and punishment without the mind being cognizant of them. A man may think himself injured, may wish to avenge his wrongs, and then may be persuaded by some reason or other to give up his intention and calm down. I do not call that anger. It is an emotion of the mind which is under the control of reason. Anger is that which goes beyond reason and carries her away with it. Wherefore, the first confusion of a man's mind when struck by what seems an injury is no more anger than the apparent injury itself. It is the subsequent mad rush, which not only receives the impression of the apparent injury, but acts upon it as true, that is anger, being an exciting of the mind to revenge, which proceeds from choice and deliberate resolve. There never has been any doubt that fear produces flight, and anger a rush forward. Consider, therefore, whether you suppose that anything can be either sought or avoided without the participation of the mind. 4. Furthermore, that you may know in what manner passions begin and swell and gain spirit, learn that the first emotion is involuntary, and is, as it were, a preparation for a passion, and a threatening of one. The next is combined with a wish, though not an obstinate one, as, for example, it is my duty to avenge myself, because I have been injured, or it is right that this man should be punished, because he has committed a crime. The third emotion is already beyond our control, because it overrides reason and wishes to avenge itself, not if it be its duty, but whether or no. We are not able, by means of reason, to escape from that first impression on the mind, any more than we can escape from those things which we have mentioned as occurring to the body. We cannot prevent other people's yawns tempting us to yawn. We cannot help blinking when fingers are suddenly darted at our eyes. Reason is unable to overcome these habits, which perhaps might be weakened by practice and constant watchfulness. They differ from an emotion, which is brought into existence and brought to an end by a deliberate mental act. 5. We must also inquire whether those whose cruelty knows no bounds and who delight in shedding human blood are angry when they kill people from whom they have received no injury, and who they themselves do not think have done them any injury, such as were Apollodorus or Phalaris. This is not anger, it is ferocity, for it does not do hurt because it has received injury, but is willing even to receive injury, provided that it may do hurt. It does not long to inflict stripes and mangle bodies to avenge its wrongs, but for its own pleasure. What, then, are we to say? This evil takes its rise from anger, for anger, after it has, by long use and indulgence, made a man forget mercy and driven all feelings of human fellowship from his mind, passes finally into cruelty. Such men, therefore, laugh, rejoice, enjoy themselves greatly, and are as unlike as possible in countenance to angry men, since cruelty is their relaxation. It is said that when Hannibal saw a trench full of human blood, he exclaimed, "Oh, what a beauteous sight!" How much more beautiful would he have thought it if it had filled a river or a lake? Why should we wonder that you should be charmed with this sight above all others, you who are born in bloodshed and brought up amid slaughter from a child? Fortune will follow you and favour your cruelty for 20 years, and will display to you everywhere the sight that you love. You will behold it both at Trasimene and at Cannae, and lastly at your own city of Carthage. Valesus, who not long ago under the Emperor Augustus was proconsul of Asia Minor, after he had one day beheaded 300 persons, strutted out among the corpses with a haughty air, as though he had performed some grand and notable exploit, and exclaimed in Greek, "What a kingly action!" What would this man have done had he been really a king? This was not anger, but a greater and incurable disease. 6. Virtue, argues our adversary, ought to be angry with what is base, just as she approves of what is honourable. What should we think if he said that virtue ought to be both mean and great? Yet this is what he means when he wants her to be raised and lowered, because joy at a good action is grand and glorious, while anger at another's sin is base and befits a narrow mind, and virtue will never be guilty of imitating vice while she is repressing it. She considers anger to deserve punishment for itself, since it is often even more criminal than the faults with which it is angry. To rejoice and be glad is the proper and natural function of virtue. It is as much beneath her dignity to be angry as to mourn. Now, sorrow is the companion of anger, and all anger ends in sorrow, either from remorse or from failure. Secondly, if it be the part of the wise man to be angry with sins, he will be more angry the greater they are, and will often be angry. From which it follows that the wise man will not only be angry, but irascible. Yet if we do not believe that great and frequent anger can find any place in the wise man's mind, why should we not set him altogether free from this passion? For there can be no limit if he ought to be angry in proportion to what every man does, because he will either be unjust if he is equally angry at unequal crimes, or he will be the most irascible of men if he blazes into wrath as often as crimes deserve his anger. 7. What, too, can be more unworthy of the wise man than that his passions should depend upon the wickedness of others? If so, the great Socrates will no longer be able to return home with the same expression of countenance with which he set out. Moreover, if it be the duty of the wise man to be angry at base deeds, and to be excited and saddened at crimes, then is there nothing more unhappy than the wise man, for all his life will be spent in anger and grief. What moment will there be at which he will not see something deserving of blame? Whenever he leaves his house, he will be obliged to walk among men who are criminals, misers, spendthrifts, profligates, and who are happy in being so. He can turn his eyes in no direction without their finding something to shock them. He will faint if he demands anger from himself as often as reason calls for it. All these thousands who are hurrying to the law courts at break of day, how base are their causes, and how much baser their advocates. One impugns his father's will, when he would have done better to deserve it. Another appears as the accuser of his mother. A third comes to inform against a man for committing the very crime of which he himself is yet more notoriously guilty. The judge, too, is chosen to condemn men for doing what he himself has done, and the audience takes the wrong side, led astray by the fine voice of the pleader. 8. Why need I dwell upon individual cases? Be assured, when you see the forum crowded with a multitude, the sceptre swarming with people, or the great circus, in which the greater part of the people find room to show themselves at once, that among them there are as many vices as there are men. Among those whom you see in the garb of peace, there is no peace. For a small profit, any one of them will attempt the ruin of another. No one can gain anything save by another's loss. They hate the fortunate and despise the unfortunate. They grudgingly endure the great and oppress the small. They are fired by diverse lusts. They would wreck everything for the sake of a little pleasure or plunder. They live as though they were in a school of gladiators, fighting with the same people with whom they live. It is like a society of wild beasts, save that beasts are tame with one another, and refrain from biting their own species, whereas men tear one another, and gorge themselves upon one another. They differ from dumb animals in this alone, that the latter are tame with those who feed them, whereas the rage of the former preys on those very persons by whom they were brought up. 9. The wise man will never cease to be angry if he once begins, so full is every place of vices and crimes. More evil is done than can be healed by punishment. Men seem engaged in a vast race of wickedness. Every day there is greater eagerness to sin, less modesty. Throwing aside all reverence for what is better and more just, lust rushes whithersoever it thinks fit. And crimes are no longer committed by stealth, they take place before our eyes. And wickedness has become so general and gained such a footing in everyone's breast that innocence is no longer rare, but no longer exists. Do men break the law singly or a few at a time? Nay, they rise in all quarters at once, as though obeying some universal signal, to wipe out the boundaries of right and wrong. Host is not safe from guest, father-in-law from son, but seldom love exists twixt brothers. Wives long to destroy their husbands, husbands long to slay their wives. Stepmothers deadly aconites prepare, and child heirs wonder when their sires will die. And how small a part of men's crimes are these! The poet has not described one people divided into two hostile camps, parents and children enrolled on opposite sides, Rome set on fire by the hand of a Roman, troops of fierce horsemen scouring the country to track down the hiding places of the proscribed, wells defiled by poison, plagues created by human hands, trenches dug by children round their beleaguered parents, crowded prisons, conflagrations that consume whole cities, gloomy tyrannies, secret plots to establish despotisms and ruin peoples, and men glorying in those deeds which, as long as it was possible to repress them, were counted as crimes, I mean rape, debauchery, and lust. Add to these public acts of national bad faith, broken treaties, everything that cannot defend itself carried off as plunder by the stronger, knaveries, thefts, frauds, and disownings of debt, such as three of our present law courts would not suffice to deal with. if you want the wise man to be as angry as the atrocity of men's crimes requires, he must not merely be angry, but must go mad with rage. 10. You will rather think that we should not be angry with people's faults. For what shall we say of one who is angry with those who stumble in the dark, or with deaf people who cannot hear his orders, or with children because they forget their duty and interest themselves in the games and silly jokes of their companions? What shall we say if you choose to be angry with weaklings for being sick, for growing old, or becoming fatigued? Among the other misfortunes of humanity is this, that men's intellects are confused, and they not only cannot help going wrong, but love to go wrong. To avoid being angry with individuals, you must pardon the whole mass. You must grant forgiveness to the entire human race. If you are angry with young and old men because they do wrong, you will be angry with infants also, for they soon will do wrong. Does anyone become angry with children, who are too young to comprehend distinctions? Yet to be a human being is a greater and better excuse than to be a child. Thus are we born, as creatures liable to as many disorders of the mind as of the body, not dull and slow-witted, but making a bad use of our keenness of wit, and leading one another into vice by our example. He who follows others who have started before him on the wrong road is surely excusable for having wandered on the highway. A general severity may be shown in the case of individual deserters, but where a whole army deserts, it must needs be pardoned. What is it that puts a stop to the wise man's anger? It is the number of sinners. He perceives how unjust and how dangerous it is to be angry with vices which all men share. Heraclitus, whenever he came out of doors and beheld around him such a number of men who were living wretchedly, nay, rather perishing wretchedly, used to weep. He pitied all those who met him joyous and happy. He was of a gentle but too weak disposition, and he himself was one of those whom he ought to have wept. Democritus, on the other hand, is said never to have appeared in public without laughing, so little did men's serious occupations appear serious to him. Everything ought either to move us to tears or to laughter. The wise man will not be angry with sinners. Why not? Because he knows that no one is born wise, but becomes so. He knows that very few wise men are produced in any age, because he thoroughly understands the circumstances of human life. Now, no sane man is angry with nature, for what should we say if a man chose to be surprised that fruit did not hang on the thickets of a forest, or to wonder at bushes and thorns not being covered with some useful berry? No one is angry when nature excuses a defect. The wise man, therefore, being tranquil and dealing candidly with mistakes, not an enemy to, but an improver of sinners, will go abroad every day in the following frame of mind. Many men will meet me who are drunkards, lustful, ungrateful, greedy, and excited by the frenzy of ambition. He will view all these things as benignly as a physician does his patients. When a man's ship leaks freely through its open seams, does he become angry with the sailors or the ship itself? No. Instead of that, he tries to remedy it. He shuts out some water, bails out some other, closes all the holes that he can see, and by ceaseless labour counteracts those which are out of sight and which let water into the hold. Nor does he relax his efforts, because as much water as he pumps out runs in again. We need a long-breathed struggle against permanent and prolific evils, not, indeed, to quell them, but merely to prevent their overpowering us. 11. Anger, says our opponent, is useful because it avoids contempt and because it frightens bad men. Now, In the first place, if anger is strong in proportion to its threats, it is hateful for the same reason that it is terrible, and it is more dangerous to be hated than to be despised. If, again, it is without strength, it is much more exposed to contempt and cannot avoid ridicule. For what is more flat than anger when it breaks out into meaningless ravings? Moreover, because some things are somewhat terrible, they are not on that account desirable. Nor does wisdom wish it to be said of the wise man, as it is of a wild beast, that the fear which he inspires is a weapon to him. Why, do we not fear fever, gout, consuming ulcers, and is there, for that reason, any good in them? Nay, on the other hand, they are all despised and thought to be foul and base, and are for this very reason feared. So, too, anger is in itself hideous, and by no means to be feared. Yet it is feared by many, just as a hideous mask is feared by children. How can we answer the fact that terror always works back to him who inspired it? And that no one is feared who is himself at peace. At this point, it is well that you should remember that verse of Liberius, which, when pronounced in the theatre during the height of the civil war, caught the fancy of the whole people as though it expressed the national feeling. He must fear many whom so many fear. Thus has nature ordained that whatever becomes great by causing fear to others is not free from fear itself. How disturbed lions are at the faintest noises, how excited those fiercest of beasts become at strange shadows, voices or smells. Whatever is a terror to others fears for itself. There can be no reason, therefore, for any wise man to wish to be feared, and no one need think that anger is anything great because it strikes terror. Since even the most despicable things are feared, as, for example, noxious vermin whose bite is venomous, and since a string set with feathers stops the largest herd of wild beasts and guides them into traps, it is no wonder that from its effect it should be named a scarer. Foolish creatures are frightened by foolish things. The movement of chariots and the sight of their wheels turning round drives lions back into their cage. Elephants are frightened at the cries of pigs, and so also we fear anger just as children fear the dark, or wild beasts fear red feathers. It has in itself nothing solid or valiant, but it affects feeble minds. 12. Wickedness, says our adversary, must be removed from the system of nature, if you wish to remove anger, neither of which things can be done. In the first place, it is possible for a man not to be cold, although according to the system of nature it may be winter time, nor yet to suffer from heat, although it be summer according to the almanac. He may be protected against the inclement time of the year, by dwelling in a favoured spot, or he may have so trained his body to endurance that it feels neither heat nor cold. Next, reverse this saying. You must remove anger from your mind before you can take virtue into the same, because vices and virtues cannot combine, and none can at the same time be both an angry man and a good man, any more than he can be both sick and well. It is not possible, says he, to remove anger altogether from the mind, nor does human nature admit of it. Yet there is nothing so hard and difficult that the mind of man cannot overcome it, and with which unremitting study will not render him familiar. Nor are there any passions so fierce and independent that they cannot be tamed by discipline. The mind can carry out whatever orders it gives itself. Some have succeeded in never smiling, some have forbidden themselves wine, sexual intercourse, or even drink of all kinds. Some, who are satisfied with short hours of rest, have learned to watch for long periods without weariness. Men have learned to run upon the thinnest ropes, even when slanting, to carry huge burdens, scarcely within the compass of human strength, or to dive to enormous depths and suffer themselves to remain under the sea without any chance of drawing breath. There are 1,000 other instances in which application has conquered all obstacles, and proved that nothing which the mind has set itself to endure is difficult. The men whom I have just mentioned gain either no reward, or one that is unworthy of their unwearied application. For what great thing does a man gain by applying his intellect to walking upon a tightrope, or to placing great burdens upon his shoulders, or to keeping sleep from his eyes? And yet their patient labour brings all these things to pass for a trifling reward. Shall not we then call in the aid of patience, we whom such a prize awaits, the unbroken calm of a happy life? How great a blessing is it to escape from anger, that chief of all evils, and therewith from frenzy, ferocity, cruelty and madness, its attendants. 13. There is no reason why we should seek to defend such a passion as this, or excuse its excesses by declaring it to be either useful or unavoidable. What vice, indeed, is without its defenders? Yet this is no reason why you should declare anger to be ineradicable. The evils from which we suffer are curable, and since we were born with a natural bias towards good, nature herself will help us if we try to amend our lives. Nor is the path to virtue steep and rough, as some think it to be. It may be reached on level ground. This is no untrue tale which I come to tell you. The road to happiness is easy. Do you only enter upon it with good luck and the good help of the gods themselves? It is much harder to do what you are doing. What is more restful than a mind at peace, and what more toilsome than anger? What is more at leisure than clemency? What fuller of business than cruelty? Modesty keeps holiday, while vice is overwhelmed with work. In fine, the culture of any of the virtues is easy, while vices require a great expense. Anger ought to be removed from our minds. Even those who say it ought to be kept low admit this to some extent. Let it be got rid of altogether. There is nothing to be gained by it. Without it, we can more easily and more justly put an end to crime, punish bad men, and amend their lives. The wise man will do his duty in all things without the help of any evil passion, and will use no auxiliaries which require watching narrowly, lest they get beyond his control. 14. Anger, then, must never become a habit with us, but we may sometimes affect to be angry when we wish to rouse up the dull minds of those whom we address, just as we rouse up horses who are slow at starting with goads and firebrands. We must sometimes apply fear to persons upon whom reason makes no impression. Yet to be angry is of no more use than to grieve or to be afraid. What? Do not circumstances arise which provoke us to anger? Yes, but at those times above all others we ought to choke down our wrath. Nor is it difficult to conquer our spirit, seeing that athletes who devote their whole attention to the basest parts of themselves nevertheless are able to endure blows and pain in order to exhaust the strength of the striker, and do not strike when anger bids them, but when opportunity invites them. It is said that Pyrrhus, the most celebrated trainer of gymnastic contests, used habitually to impress upon his pupils not to lose their tempers, for anger spoils their science, and thinks only how it can hurt, so that often reason counsels patience, while anger counsels revenge, and we, who might have survived our first misfortunes, are exposed to worse ones. Some have been driven into exile by their impatience of a single contemptuous word, have been plunged into the deepest miseries because they would not endure the most trifling wrong in silence, and have brought upon themselves the yoke of slavery because they were too proud to give up the least part of their entire liberty. XV. That you may be sure, says our opponent, that anger has in it something noble, pray look at the free nations, such as the Germans and Scythians, who are especially prone to anger. The reason of this is that stout and daring intellects are liable to anger before they are tamed by discipline, for some passions engraft themselves upon the better class of dispositions only, just as good land, even when waste, grows strong brushwood, and the trees are tall which stand upon a fertile soil. In like manner, dispositions which are naturally bold produce irritability, and, being hot and fiery, have no mean or trivial qualities. But their energy is misdirected, as happens with all those who, without training, come to the front by their natural advantages alone, whose minds, unless they be brought under control, degenerate from a courageous temper into habits of rashness and reckless daring. What? Are not milder spirits linked with gentler vices, such as tenderness of heart, love, and bashfulness? Yes, and therefore I can often point out to you a good disposition by its own faults. Yet there being the proofs of a superior nature does not prevent there being vices. Moreover, all those nations which are free because they are wild, like lions or wolves, cannot command any more than they can obey, for the strength of their intellect is not civilized, but fierce and unmanageable. Now, no one is able to rule unless he is also able to be ruled. Consequently, the empire of the world has almost always remained in the hands of those nations who enjoy a milder climate. Those who dwell near the frozen north have uncivilized temper. Just on the model of their native skies, as the poet has it. 16. Those animals, urges our opponent, are held to be the most generous who have large capacity for anger. He is mistaken when he holds up creatures who act from impulse instead of reason as patterns for men to follow, because in man reason takes the place of impulse. Yet even with animals, all do not alike profit by the same thing. Anger is of use to lions, timidity to stags, boldness to hawks, flight to doves. What if I declare that it is not even true that the best animals are the most prone to anger? I may suppose that wild beasts, who gain their food by rapine, are better the angrier they are, but I should praise oxen and horses who obey the rein for their patience. What reason, however, have you for referring mankind to such wretched models, when you have the universe and God, whom he alone of animals imitates because he alone comprehends him? The most irritable men, says he, are thought to be the most straightforward of all. Yes, because they are compared with swindlers and sharpers, and appear to be simple because they are outspoken. I should not call such men simple, but heedless. We give this title of simple to all fools, gluttons, spendthrifts, and men whose vices lie on the surface. 17. An orator, says our opponent, sometimes speaks better when he is angry. Not so, but when he pretends to be angry. For so also actors bring down the house by their playing, not when they are really angry, but when they act the angry man well. And in like manner, in addressing a jury or a popular assembly, or in any other position in which the minds of others have to be influenced at our pleasure, we must ourselves pretend to feel anger, fear, or pity, before we can make others feel them. And often the pretense of passion will do what the passion itself could not have done. The mind which does not feel anger, says he, is feeble. true if it has nothing stronger than anger to support it. A man ought to be neither robber nor victim, neither tender-hearted nor cruel. The former belongs to an over-weak mind, the latter to an over-hard one. Let the wise man be moderate, and when things have to be done somewhat briskly, let him call force, not anger, to his aid. Now that we have discussed the questions propounded concerning anger, let us pass on to the consideration of its remedies. These, I imagine, are twofold. The one class preventing our becoming angry, the other preventing our doing wrong when we are angry. As with the body, we adopt a certain regimen to keep ourselves in health and use different rules to bring back health when lost. So likewise, we must repel anger in one fashion and quench it in another. That we may avoid it, certain rules of conduct which apply to all men's lives must be impressed upon us. We may divide these into such as are of use during the education of the young and in afterlife. Education ought to be carried on with the greatest and most salutary assiduity, for it is easy to mould minds while they are still tender, but it is difficult to uproot vices which have grown up with ourselves. 19. A hot mind is naturally the most prone to anger, for as there are four elements, consisting of fire, air, earth, and water, so there are powers corresponding and equivalent to each of these, namely hot, cold, dry, and moist. Now the mixture of the elements is the cause of the diversities of lands and of animals, of bodies and of character, and our dispositions incline to one or the other of these according as the strength of each element prevails in us. Hence it is that we call some regions wet or dry, warm or cold. The same distinctions apply likewise to animals and mankind. It makes a great difference how much moisture or heat a man contains. His character will partake of whichever element has the largest share in him. A warm temperature of mind will make men prone to anger, for fire is full of movement and vigour. A mixture of coldness makes men cowards, for cold is sluggish and contracted. Because of this, some of our Stoics think that anger is excited in our breasts by the boiling of the blood round the heart. Indeed, that place is assigned to anger for no other reason than because the breast is the warmest part of the whole body. Those who have more moisture in them become angry by slow degrees, because they have no heat ready at hand, but it has to be obtained by movement. Wherefore the anger of women and children is sharp rather than strong, and arises on lighter provocation. At dry times of life, anger is violent and powerful, yet without increase and adding little to itself, because as heat dies away, cold takes its place. Old men are testy and full of complaints, as also are sick people and convalescents, and all whose store of heat has been consumed by weariness or loss of blood. Those who are wasted by thirst or hunger are in the same condition, as also are those whose frame is naturally bloodless and faints from want of generous diet. Wine kindles anger, because it increases heat. According to each man's disposition, some fly into a passion when they are heavily drunk, some when they are slightly drunk. Nor is there any other reason than this why yellow-haired, ruddy-complexioned people should be excessively passionate, seeing that they are naturally of the colour which others put on during anger, for their blood is hot and easily set in motion. 20. But just as nature makes some men prone to anger, so there are many other causes which have the same power as nature. Some are brought into this condition by disease or bodily injury, others by hard work, long watching, nights of anxiety, ardent longings, and love. And everything else which is hurtful to the body or the spirit inclines the distempered mind to find fault. All these, however, are but the beginning and the causes of anger. Habit of mind has very great power, and, if it be harsh, increases the disorder. As for nature, it is difficult to alter it, nor may we change the mixture of the elements which was formed once for all at our birth. Yet knowledge will be so far of service that we should keep wine out of the reach of hot-tempered men, which Plato thinks ought also to be forbidden to boys, so that fire be not made fiercer. Neither should such men be overfed, for if so, their bodies will swell, and their minds will swell with them. Such men ought to take exercise, stopping short, however, of fatigue, in order that their natural heat may be abated, but not exhausted, and their excess of fiery spirit may be worked off. Games also will be useful, for moderate pleasure relieves the mind and brings it to a proper balance. With those temperaments which incline to moisture or dryness and stiffness, there is no danger of anger, but there is fear of greater vices, such as cowardice, moroseness, despair, and suspiciousness. Such dispositions therefore ought to be softened, comforted, and restored to cheerfulness. And since we must make use of different remedies for anger and for sullenness, and these two vices require not only unlike, but absolutely opposite modes of treatment, let us always attack that one of them which is gaining the mastery. 21. It is, I assure you, of the greatest service to boys that they should be soundly brought up. Yet to regulate their education is difficult, because it is our duty to be careful neither to cherish a habit of anger in them, nor to blunt the edge of their spirit. This needs careful watching, for both qualities, both those which are to be encouraged and those which are to be checked, are fed by the same things, and even a careful watcher may be deceived by their likeness. A boy's spirit is increased by freedom and depressed by slavery. It rises when praised, and is led to conceive great expectations of itself. Yet this same treatment produces arrogance and quickness of temper. We must, therefore, guide him between these two extremes, using the curb at one time and the spur at another. He must undergo no servile or degrading treatment. He must never beg abjectly for anything, nor must he gain anything by begging. Let him rather receive it for his own sake, for his past good behaviour, or for his promises of future good conduct. In contests with his comrades, we ought not to allow him to become sulky or fly into a passion. Let us see that he be on friendly terms with those whom he contends with, so that in the struggle itself he may learn to wish not to hurt his antagonist, but to conquer him. Whenever he has gained the day or done something praiseworthy, we should allow him to enjoy his victory, but not to rush into transports of delight, for joy leads to exultation, and exultation leads to swaggering and excessive self-esteem. We ought to allow him some relaxation, yet not yield him up to laziness and sloth, and we ought to keep him far beyond the reach of luxury, for nothing makes children more prone to anger than a soft and fond bringing up, so that the more only children are indulged, and the more liberty is given to orphans, the more they are corrupted. He to whom nothing is ever denied will not be able to endure a rebuff, whose anxious mother always wipes away his tears, whose pedagogus is made to pay for his shortcomings. Do you not observe how a man's anger becomes more violent as he rises in station? This shows itself especially in those who are rich and noble, or in great place, when the favouring gale has roused all the most empty and trivial passions of their minds. Prosperity fosters anger. When a man's proud ears are surrounded by a mob of flatterers, saying, "That man answer you. You do not act according to your dignity. You lower yourself." And so forth, with all the language which can hardly be resisted even by healthy and originally well-principled minds. Flattery, then, must be kept well out of the way of children. Let a child hear the truth, and sometimes fear it. Let him always reverence it. Let him rise in the presence of his elders. Let him obtain nothing by flying into a passion. Let him be given, when he is quiet, what was refused him when he cried for it. Let him behold, but not make use of, his father's wealth. Let him be reproved for what he does wrong. It will be advantageous to furnish boys with even-tempered teachers and pedagogy. What is soft and unformed clings to what is near and takes its shape. The habits of young men reproduce those of their nurses and pedagogy. Once a boy who was brought up in Plato's house went home to his parents, and on seeing his father shouting with passion, said, "I never saw anyone in Plato's house act like that." I doubt not that he learned to imitate his father sooner than he learned to imitate Plato. Above all, let his food be scanty, his dress not costly, and of the same fashion as that of his comrades. If you begin by putting him on a level with many others, he will not be angry when someone is compared with him. 22. These precepts, however, apply to our children. In ourselves, the accident of birth and our education no longer admits either of mistakes or of advice. We must deal with what follows. Now we ought to fight against the first causes of evil. The cause of anger is the belief that we are injured. This belief, therefore, should not be lightly entertained. We ought not to fly into a rage even when the injury appears to be open and distinct, for some false things bear the semblance of truth. We should always allow some time to elapse, for time discloses the truth. Let not our ears be easily lent to calumnious talk. Let us know and be on our guard against this fault of human nature, that we are willing to believe what we are unwilling to listen to, and that we become angry before we have formed our opinion. What shall I say? We are influenced not merely by calumnies, but by suspicions, and at the very look and smile of others, we may fly into a rage with innocent persons, because we put the worst construction upon it. We ought, therefore, to plead the cause of the absent against ourselves, and to keep our anger in abeyance. For a punishment which has been postponed may yet be inflicted, but when once inflicted, cannot be recalled. 23. Everyone knows the story of the tyrannicide who, being caught before he had accomplished his task, and being tortured by Hippias to make him betray his accomplices, named the friends of the tyrant who stood around, and everyone to whom he knew the tyrant's safety was especially dear. As the tyrant ordered each man to be slain as he was named, at last the man, being asked if anyone else remained, said, "You remain alone, for I have left no one else alive to whom you are dear." Anger made the tyrant lend his assistance to the tyrant slayer, and cut down his guards with his own sword. How far more spirited was Alexander, who, after reading his mother's letter warning him to beware of poison from his physician Philip, nevertheless drank undismayed the medicine which Philip gave him. He felt more confidence in his friend. He felt more confidence in his friend. He deserved that his friend should be innocent, and deserved that his conduct should make him innocent. I praise Alexander's doing this all the more, because he was above all men prone to anger. But the rarer moderation is among kings, the more it deserves to be praised. The great Gaius Caesar, who proved such a merciful conqueror in the civil war, did the same thing. He burned a packet of letters addressed to Gnaeus Pompeius by persons who had been thought to be either neutrals or on the other side. Though he was never violent in his anger, yet he preferred to put it out of his power to be angry. He thought that the kindest way to pardon each of them was not to know what his offence had been. 24. Readiness to believe what we hear causes very great mischief. We ought often not even to listen, because in some cases it is better to be deceived than to suspect deceit. We ought to free our minds of suspicion and mistrust, those most untrustworthy causes of anger. This man's greeting was far from civil. That one would not receive my kiss. One cut short a story I had begun to tell. Another did not ask me to dinner. Another seemed to view me with aversion. Suspicion will never lack grounds. What we want is straightforwardness and a kindly interpretation of things. Let us believe nothing unless it forces itself upon our sight and is unmistakable, and let us reprove ourselves for being too ready to believe, as often as our suspicions prove to be groundless. For this discipline will render us habitually slow to believe what we hear. 25. Another consequence of this will be that we shall not be exasperated by the slightest and most contemptible trifles. It is mere madness to be put out of temper because a slave is not quick, because the water we are going to drink is lukewarm, or because our couch is disarranged, or our table carelessly laid. A man must be in a miserably bad state of health if he shrinks from a gentle breath of wind. His eyes must be diseased if they are distressed by the sight of white clothing. He must be broken down with debauchery if he feels pain at seeing another man work. It is said that there was one Mindirides, a citizen of Sybaris, who one day, seeing a man digging and variously brandishing a mattock, complained that the sight made him weary, and forbade the man to work where he could see him. The same man complained that he had suffered from the rose leaves upon which he lay, being folded double. When pleasures have corrupted both the body and the mind, nothing seems endurable, not indeed because it is hard, but because he who has to bear it is soft. For why should we be driven to frenzy by anyone's coughing and sneezing, or by a fly not being driven away with sufficient care, or by a dog's hanging about us, or by a key dropping from a careless servant's hand? Will one whose ears are agonized by the noise of a bench being dragged along the floor be able to endure with unruffled mind the rude language of party strife, and the abuse which speakers in the forum or the senate house heap upon their opponents? Will he who is angry with his slave for icing his drink badly be able to endure hunger or the thirst of a long march in summer? Nothing, therefore, nourishes anger more than excessiveness and dissatisfied luxury. The mind ought to be hardened by rough treatment, so as not to feel any blow that is not severe. 26. We are angry either with those who can or with those who cannot do us an injury. To the latter class belong some inanimate things, such as a book, which we often throw away when it is written in letters too small for us to read, or tear up when it is full of mistakes, or clothes which we destroy because we do not like them. How foolish to be angry with such things as these, which neither deserve nor feel our anger! But, of course, it is their makers who really affront us. I answer that, in the first place, we often become angry before making this distinction clear in our minds, and secondly, perhaps even the makers might put forward some reasonable excuses. One of them, it may be, could not make them any better than he did, and it was not through any disrespect to you that he was unskilled in his trade. Another may have done his work so without any intention of insulting you. And, finally, what can be more crazy than to discharge upon things the ill feeling which one has accumulated against persons? Yet as it is the act of a madman to be angry with inanimate objects, so also is it to be angry with dumb animals, which can do us no wrong because they are not able to form a purpose, and we cannot call anything a wrong unless it be done intentionally. They are, therefore, able to hurt us just as a sword or a stone may do so, but they are not able to do us a wrong. Yet some men think themselves insulted when the same horses which are docile with one rider are restive with another, as though it were through their deliberate choice, and not through habit and cleverness of handling, that some horses are more easily managed by some men than by others. And as it is foolish to be angry with them, so it is to be angry with children, and with men who have little more sense than children. For all these sins, before a just judge, ignorance would be as effective an excuse as innocence. 27. There are some things which are unable to hurt us, and whose power is exclusively beneficial and salutary, as, for example, the immortal gods, who neither wish nor are able to do harm. For their temperament is naturally gentle and tranquil, and no more likely to wrong others than to wrong themselves. Foolish people who know not the truth hold them answerable for storms at sea, excessive rain, and long winters, whereas all the while these phenomena by which we suffer or profit take place without any reference whatever to us. It is not for our sake that the universe causes summer and winter to succeed one another. These have a law of their own, according to which their divine functions are performed. We think too much of ourselves when we imagine that we are worthy to have such prodigious revolutions effected for our sake. So, then, none of these things take place in order to do us an injury. Nay, on the contrary, they all tend to our benefit. I have said that there are some things which cannot hurt us, and some which would not. To the latter class belong good men in authority, good parents, teachers, and judges, whose punishments ought to be submitted to by us in the same spirit in which we undergo the surgeon's knife, abstinence from food, and such like things which hurt us for our benefit. Suppose that we are being punished. Let us think not only of what we suffer, but of what we have done. Let us sit in judgment on our past life. Provided we are willing to tell ourselves the truth, we shall certainly decide that our crimes deserve a harder measure than they have received. 28. If we desire to be impartial judges of all that takes place, we must first convince ourselves of this, that no one of us is faultless. For it is from this that most of our indignation proceeds. I have not sinned, I have done no wrong. Say rather, you do not admit that you have done any wrong. We are infuriated at being reproved, either by reprimand or actual chastisement, although we are sinning at that very time, by adding insolence and obstinacy to our wrongdoings. Who is there that can declare himself to have broken no laws? Even if there be such a man, what a stinted innocence it is merely to be innocent by the letter of the law. How much further do the rules of duty extend than those of the law? How many things which are not to be found in the statute book are demanded by filial feeling, kindness, generosity, equity, and honour? Yet we are not able to warrant ourselves even to come under that first narrowest definition of innocence. We have done what was wrong, thought what was wrong, wished for what was wrong, and encouraged what was wrong. In some cases, we have only remained innocent because we did not succeed. When we think of this, let us deal more justly with sinners, and believe that those who scold us are right. In any case, let us not be angry with ourselves, for with whom shall we not be angry if we are angry even with our own selves, and least of all with the gods? For whatever we suffer befalls us not by any ordinance of theirs, but of the common law of all flesh. but diseases and pains attack us. Well, people who live in a crazy dwelling must have some way of escape from it. Someone will be said to have spoken ill of you. Think whether you did not first speak ill of him. Think of how many persons you have yourself spoken ill. Let us not, I say, suppose that others are doing us a wrong, but are repaying one which we have done them, that some are acting with good intentions. Let us not, I say, suppose that others are doing us a wrong, but are repaying one which we have done them, that some are acting with good intentions, some under compulsion, some in ignorance, and let us believe that even he who does so intentionally and knowingly did not wrong us merely for the sake of wronging us, but was led into doing so by the attraction of saying something witty, or did whatever he did, not out of any spite against us, but because he himself could not succeed unless he pushed us back. We are often offended by flattery, even while it is being lavished upon us. Yet whoever recalls to his mind how often he himself has been the victim of undeserved suspicion, how often fortune has given his true service an appearance of wrongdoing, how many persons he has begun by hating and ended by loving, will be able to keep himself from becoming angry straightway, especially if he silently says to himself, when each offence is committed, "I have done this very thing myself." Where, however, will you find so impartial a judge? The same man who lusts after everyone's wife, and thinks that a woman's belonging to someone else is a sufficient reason for adoring her, will not allow anyone else to look at his own wife. No man expects such exact fidelity as a traitor. The perjurer himself takes vengeance on him who breaks his word. The pettifogging lawyer is most indignant at an action being brought against him. The man who is reckless of his own chastity cannot endure any attempt upon that of his slaves. We have other men's vices before our eyes, and our own behind our backs. Hence it is that a father, who is worse than his son, blames the latter for giving extravagant feasts, and disapproves of the least sign of luxury in another, although he was wont to set no bounds to it in his own case. Hence it is that despots are angry with homicides, and thefts are punished by those who despoil temples. A great part of mankind is not angry with sins, but with sinners. Regard to our own selves will make us more moderate if we inquire of ourselves, have we ever committed any crime of this sort? Have we ever fallen into this kind of error? Is it for our interest that we should condemn this conduct? The greatest remedy for anger is delay. Beg anger to grant you this at the first, not in order that it may pardon the offence, but that it may form a right judgment about it. If it delays, it will come to an end. Do not attempt to quell it all at once, for its first impulses are fierce. By plucking away its parts, we shall remove the whole. We are made angry by some things which we learn at second hand, and by some which we ourselves hear or see. Now, we ought to be slow to believe what is told us. Many tell lies in order to deceive us, and many because they themselves are deceived. Some seek to win our favour by false accusations, and invent wrongs in order that they may appear angry at our having suffered them. One man lies out of spite, that he may set trusting friends at variance, some because they are suspicious and wish to see sport, and watch from a safe distance those whom they have set by the ears. If you were about to give sentence in court about ever so small a sum of money, you would take nothing as proved without a witness, and a witness would count for nothing except on his oath. You would allow both sides to be heard, you would allow them time, you would not dispatch the matter at one sitting, because the oftener it is handled, the more distinctly the truth appears. And do you condemn your friend offhand? Are you angry with him before you hear his story, before you have cross-examined him, before you can know either who is his accuser or with what he is charged? Why, then, just now, in the case which you just heard, did you hear what was said on both sides? This very man who has informed against your friend will say no more if he be obliged to prove what he says. You need not, he says, bring me forward as a witness. If I am brought forward, I shall deny what I have said. Unless you excuse me from appearing, I shall never tell you anything. At the same time, he spurs you on and withdraws himself from the strife and battle. The man who will tell you nothing save in secret hardly tells you anything at all. What can be more unjust than to believe in secret and to be angry openly? 30. Some offences we ourselves witness. In these cases, let us examine the disposition and purpose of the offender. Perhaps he is a child. Let us pardon his youth. He knows not whether he is doing wrong. Or he is a father. He has either rendered such great services as to have won the right even to wrong us, or perhaps this very act which offends us is his chief merit. Or a woman. Well, she made a mistake. The man did it because he was ordered to do it. Who but an unjust person can be angry with what is done under compulsion? You had hurt him? Well, there is no wrong in suffering the pain which you have been the first to inflict. Suppose that your opponent is a judge, then you ought to take his opinion rather than your own, or that he is a king. Then, if he punishes the guilty, yield to him because he is just, and if he punishes the innocent, yield to him because he is powerful. Suppose that it is a dumb animal, or as stupid as a dumb animal. Then, if you are angry with it, you will make yourself like it. Suppose that it is a disease or a misfortune. It will take less effect upon you if you bear it quietly. Or that it is a god. Then you waste your time by being angry with him, as much as if you prayed him to be angry with someone else. Is it a good man who has wronged you? Do not believe it. Is it a bad one? Do not be surprised at this. He will pay to someone else the penalty which he owes to you. Indeed, by his sin, he has already punished himself. 31. There are, as I have stated, two cases which produce anger. First, when we appear to have received an injury, about which enough has been said. And secondly, when we appear to have been treated unjustly. This must now be discussed. Men think some things unjust because they ought not to suffer them, and some because they did not expect to suffer them. We think what is unexpected is beneath our deserts. Consequently, we are especially excited at what befalls us contrary to our hope and expectation. And this is why we are irritated at the smallest trifles in our own domestic affairs, and why we call our friend's carelessness deliberate injury. How is it, then, asks our opponent, that we are angered by the injuries inflicted by our enemies? It is because we did not expect those particular injuries, or, at any rate, not on so extensive a scale. This is caused by our excessive self-love. We think that we ought to remain uninjured, even by our enemies. Every man bears within his breast the mind of a despot, and is willing to commit excesses, but unwilling to submit to them. Thus it is either ignorance or arrogance that makes us angry. Ignorance of common facts, for what is there to wonder at in bad men committing evil deeds? What novelty is there in your enemy hurting you, your friend quarrelling with you, your son going wrong, or your servant doing amiss? Fabius was wont to say that the most shameful excuse a general could make was, "I did not think." I think it the most shameful excuse that a man can make. Think of everything, expect everything. Even with men of good character, something queer will crop up. Human nature produces minds that are treacherous, ungrateful, greedy, and impious. When you are considering what any man's morals may be, think what those of mankind are. When you are especially enjoying yourself, be especially on your guard. When everything seems to you to be peaceful, be sure that mischief is not absent, but only asleep. Always believe that something will occur to offend you. A pilot never spreads all his canvas abroad so confidently as not to keep his tackle for shortening sail ready for use. Think, above all, how base and hateful is the power of doing mischief, and how unnatural in man, by whose kindness even fierce animals are rendered tame. See how bulls yield their necks to the yoke, how elephants allow boys and women to dance on their backs unhurt, how snakes glide harmlessly over our bosoms and among our drinking cups, how within their dens bears and lions submit to be handled with complacent mouths, and wild beasts fawn upon their master. Let us blush to have exchanged habits with wild beasts. It is a crime to injure one's country. So it is, therefore, to injure any of our countrymen, for he is a part of our country. If the whole be sacred, the parts must be sacred too. Therefore, it is also a crime to injure any man, for he is your fellow citizen in a larger state. What if the hands were to wish to hurt the feet, or the eyes to hurt the hands? As all the limbs act in unison, because it is the interest of the whole body to keep each one of them safe, so men should spare one another, because they are born for society. The bond of society, however, cannot exist unless it guards and loves all its members. We should not even destroy vipers and water snakes and other creatures whose teeth and claws are dangerous, if we were able to tame them as we do other animals, or to prevent their being a peril to us. Neither ought we, therefore, to hurt a man because he has done wrong, but lest he should do wrong. And our punishment should always look to the future, and never to the past, because it is inflicted in a spirit of precaution, not of anger. For if everyone who has a crooked and vicious disposition were to be punished, no one would escape punishment. 32. But anger possesses a certain pleasure of its own, and it is sweet to pay back the pain you have suffered. Not at all. It is not honourable to requite injuries by injuries, in the same way as it is to repay benefits by benefits. In the latter case, it is a shame to be conquered. In the former, it is a shame to conquer. Revenge and retaliation are words which men use and even think to be righteous, yet they do not greatly differ from wrongdoing, except in the order in which they are done. He who renders pain for pain has more excuse for his sin, that is all. Someone who did not know Marcus Cato struck him in the public bath in his ignorance, for who would knowingly have done him an injury? Afterwards, when he was apologizing, Cato replied, "I do not remember being struck." He thought it better to ignore the insult than to revenge it. You ask, did no harm befall that man for his insolence? No, but rather much good. He made the acquaintance of Cato. It is the part of a great mind to despise wrongs done to it. The most contemptuous form of revenge is not to deem one's adversary worth taking vengeance upon. Many have taken small injuries much more seriously to heart than they need, by revenging them. That man is great and noble, who, like a large wild animal, hears unmoved the tiny curs that bark at him. 33. We are treated, says our opponent, with more respect if we revenge our injuries. If we make use of revenge merely as a remedy, let us use it without anger, and not regard revenge as pleasant, but as useful. Yet often it is better to pretend not to have received an injury than to avenge it. The wrongs of the most powerful must not only be borne, but borne with a cheerful countenance. They will repeat the wrong if they think they have inflicted it. This is the worst trait of minds rendered arrogant by prosperity. They hate those whom they have injured. Everyone knows the saying of the old courtier, who, when someone asked him how he had achieved the rare distinction of living at court till he reached old age, replied, "By receiving wrongs and returning thanks for them." It is often so far from expedient to avenge our wrongs that it will not do even to admit them. Gaius Caesar, offended at the smart clothes and well-dressed hair of the son of a pastor, a distinguished Roman knight, sent him to prison. When the father begged that his son might suffer no harm, Gaius, as if reminded by this to put him to death, ordered him to be executed. Yet, in order to mitigate his brutality to the father, invited him that very day to dinner. Pastor came with the countenance which betrayed no ill will. Caesar pledged him a glass of wine and set a man to watch him. The wretched creature went through his part, feeling as though he were drinking his son's blood. The emperor sent him some perfume and a garland, and gave orders to watch whether he used them. He did so. On the very day on which he had buried, nay, on which he had not even buried his son, he sat down as one of 100 guests, and, old and gouty as he was, drank to an extent which would have been hardly decent on a child's birthday. He shed no tear the while. He did not permit his grief to betray itself by the slightest sign. He dined just as though his entreaties had gained his son's life. You ask me why he did so? He had another son. What did Priam do in the Iliad? Did he not conceal his wrath and embrace the knees of Achilles? Did he not raise to his lips that death-dealing hand, stained with the blood of his son, and sup with his slayer? True, but there were no perfumes and garlands, and his fierce enemy encouraged him with many soothing words to eat, not to drain huge goblets, with a guard standing over him to see that he did it. Had he only feared for himself, the father would have treated the tyrant with scorn. But love for his son quenched his anger. He deserved the emperor's permission to leave the banquet and gather up the bones of his son. But, meanwhile, that kindly and polite youth, the emperor, would not even permit him to do this, but tormented the old man with frequent invitations to drink, advising him thereby to lighten his sorrows. He, on the other hand, appeared to be in good spirits, and to have forgotten what had been done that day. He would have lost his second son, had he proved an unacceptable guest to the murderer of his eldest. 34. We must, therefore, refrain from anger, whether he who provokes us be on a level with ourselves, or above us, or below us. A contest with one's equal is of uncertain issue, with one's superior is folly, and with one's inferior is contemptible. It is the part of a mean and wretched man to turn and bite one's biter. Even mice and ants show their teeth if you put your hand to them, and all feeble creatures think that they are hurt if they are touched. It will make us milder tempered to call to mind any services which he with whom we are angry may have done us, and to let his deserts balance his offence. Let us also reflect how much credit the tale of our forgiveness will confer upon us, how many men may be made into valuable friends by forgiveness. One of the lessons which Sulla's cruelty teaches us is not to be angry with the children of our enemies, whether they be public or private, for he drove the sons of the proscribed into exile. Nothing is more unjust than that anyone should inherit the quarrels of his father. Whenever we are loath to pardon anyone, let us think whether it would be to our advantage that all men should be inexorable. He who refuses to pardon, how often has he begged it for himself? How often has he grovelled at the feet of those whom he spurns from his own? How can we gain more glory than by turning anger into friendship? What more faithful allies has the Roman people than those who have been its most unyielding enemies? Where would the empire be today had not the wise foresight united the conquered and the conquerors? If anyone is angry with you, meet his anger by returning benefits for it. A quarrel which is only taken up on one side falls to the ground. It takes two men to fight. But suppose that there is an angry struggle on both sides. Even then, he is the better man who first gives way. The winner is the real loser. He struck you. Well then, do you fall back? If you strike him in turn, you will give him both an opportunity and an excuse for striking you again. You will not be able to withdraw yourself from the struggle when you please. 35. Does anyone wish to strike his enemy so hard as to leave his own hand in the wound, and not to be able to recover his balance after the blow? Yet such a weapon is anger. It is scarcely possible to draw it back. We are careful to choose for ourselves light weapons, handy and manageable swords. Shall we not avoid these clumsy, unwieldy, and never-to-be-recalled impulses of the mind? The only swiftness of which men approve is that which, when bidden, checks itself and proceeds no further, and which can be guided and reduced from a run to a walk. We know that the sinews are diseased when they move against our will. A man must either be aged or weakly who runs when he wants to walk. Let us think that those are the most powerful and soundest operations of our minds, which act under our own control, not at their own caprice. Nothing, however, will be of so much service as to consider, first, the hideousness, and secondly, the danger of anger. No passion bears a more troubled aspect. It befouls the fairest face, makes fierce the expression which before was peaceful. From the angry, all grace has fled. Though their clothing may be fashionable, they will trail it on the ground and take no heed of their appearance. Though their hair may be smoothed down in a comely manner, by nature or art, yet it will bristle up in sympathy with their mind. The veins become swollen, the breast will be shaken by quick breathing, the man's neck will be swelled as he roars forth his frantic talk. Then, too, his limbs will tremble, his hands will be restless, his whole body will sway hither and thither. What, think you, must be the state of his mind within him, when its appearance without is so shocking? How far more dreadful a countenance he bears within his own breast, how far keener pride, how much more violent rage, which will burst him unless it finds some vent. Let us paint anger looking like those who are dripping with the blood of foemen or savage beasts, or those who are just about to slaughter them, like those monsters of the netherworld fabled by the poet to be girt with serpents and breathing flame, when they sally forth from hell, most frightful to behold, in order that they may kindle wars, stir up strife between nations, and overthrow peace. Let us paint her eyes glowing with fire, her voice hissing, roaring, grating, and making worse sounds, if worse there be, while she brandishes weapons in both hands, for she cares not to protect herself, gloomy, stained with blood, covered with scars and livid with her own blows, reeling like a maniac, wrapped in a thick cloud, dashing hither and thither, spreading desolation and panic, loathed by everyone and by herself above all, willing, if otherwise she cannot hurt her foe, to overthrow alike earth, sea, and heaven, harmful and hateful at the same time. Or, if we are to see her, let her be such as our poets have described her. There, with her blood-stained scourge, Bellona fights, and discord in her riven robe delights. Or, if possible, let some even more dreadful aspect be invented for this dreadful passion. 36. Some angry people, as Sextius remarks, have been benefited by looking at the glass. They have been struck by so great an alteration in their own appearance. They have been, as it were, brought into their own presence, and have not recognized themselves. Yet how small a part of the real hideousness of anger did that reflected image in the mirror reproduce? Could the mind be displayed or made to appear through any substance, we should be confounded when we beheld how black and stained, how agitated, distorted, and swollen it looked. Even at present, it is very ugly when seen through all the screens of blood, bones, and so forth. What would it be were it displayed uncovered? You say that you do not believe that anyone was ever scared out of anger by a mirror. And why not? Because when he came to the mirror to change his mind, he had changed it already. To angry men, no face looks fairer than one that is fierce and savage, and such as they wish to look like. We ought rather to consider how many men anger itself has injured. Some in their excessive heat have burst their veins, some by straining their voices beyond their strength have vomited blood, or have injured their sight by too violently injecting humours into their eyes, and have fallen sick when the fit passed off. No way loads more swiftly to madness. Many have, consequently, remained always in the frenzy of anger, and, having once lost their reason, have never recovered it. Ajax was driven mad by anger, and driven to suicide by madness. Men, frantic with rage, call upon heaven to slay their children, to reduce themselves to poverty, and to ruin their houses, and yet declare that they are not either angry or insane. Enemies to their best friends, dangerous to their nearest and dearest, regardless of the laws save where they injure, swayed by the smallest trifles, unwilling to lend their ears to the advice or the services of their friends, they do everything by main force, and are ready either to fight with their swords or to throw themselves upon them. For the greatest of all evils, and one which surpasses all vices, has gained possession of them. Other passions gain a footing in the mind by slow degrees. Anger's conquest is sudden and complete, and, moreover, it makes all other passions subservient to itself. It conquers the warmest love. Men have thrust their swords through the bodies of those whom they loved, and have slain those in whose arms they have lain. Avarice, that sternest and most rigid of passions, is trampled underfoot by anger, which forces it to squander its carefully collected wealth and set fire to its house and all its property in one heap. Why, has not even the ambitious man been known to fling away the most highly valued ensigns of rank, and to refuse high office when it was offered to him? There is no passion over which anger does not bear absolute rule.